Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Tomorrow, President Donald Trump will receive his first foreign head of state, British Prime Minister Theresa May. Yesterday, May got tough questioning in her own parliament about how tough she'll be on Trump on a variety of issues, including torture.
President Trump has repeatedly said that he will bring back torture as an instrument of policy. When she sees him on Friday, will the Prime Minister make clear that in no circumstances will she permit Britain to be dragged into facilitating that torture as we were after September the 11th?
I can assure my honourable friend that we have a very clear position on torture. We do not sanction torture. We do not get involved with that, and that will continue to be our position.
Prime Minister May, in question time in the British Parliament, don't you love how they question in the third person? Will the Prime Minister, when they're talking to the Prime Minister, she had to hear that question about torture because of statements by President Trump like this yesterday.
When they're chopping off the heads of our people and other people, when they're chopping off the heads of people because they happen to be a Christian in the Middle East, when ISIS is doing things that nobody has ever heard of since medieval times, would I feel strongly about waterboarding? As far as I'm concerned, we have to fight fire with fire. Now, with that being said, I'm going with General Mattis. I'm going with my secretary because I think Pompeo is going to be phenomenal. I'm going to go with what they say. But I have spoken as recently as 24 hours ago with people at the highest level of intelligence, and I asked them the question, does it work? Does torture work? And the answer was yes, absolutely.
President Trump yesterday, in response to another question in Parliament, British Prime Minister May also told her Parliament that she hopes all parties will ensure that the Paris Climate Change Agreement is put into practice, though she wouldn't promise to press Trump on it tomorrow. And that's just the tip of the melting iceberg as our new president's new policies begin to change the global landscape. For example, Trump was asked by ABC's David Muir yesterday about the legality of his position that the U.S. should have taken the oil for ourselves when we occupied Iraq.
So you believe we can go in and take the oil?
We should have taken the oil. You wouldn't have ISIS if we took the oil.
You've heard the critics who say that would break all international law, taking the oil. But I want to get to the words that you said.
Can you believe that? Wait, can you believe that? Who are the critics that say that? Fools. I call them fools.
Let me talk about your
words. We should have taken the oil. And if we took the oil, you wouldn't have ISIS. And we would have had wealth. We have spent right now $6 trillion in the Middle East, and our country is falling apart.
President Trump yesterday with ABC's David Muir. Joining me now is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass. He was the senior Mideast advisor to the first President Bush, director of policy planning for Secretary of State Colin Powell under the second President Bush, and he has a new book called The World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. Mr. Haass, we appreciate you coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be back.
Let me start here. You see the Obama years as a time of retrenchment, and you're critical of that. Do you see the Obama doctrine or his actions as a whole as defined by too much restraint?
The simple answer would be yes. I think in many ways he was not just a reaction but an overreaction to his predecessor. And I think when historians get around to writing the narrative of Mr. Obama's 8 years, it will more often than not be a narrative of what he did not do when it came to foreign policy. The Middle East will be exhibit number one, his inability to get the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement through Congress will be part of it. His unwillingness to do much for Ukraine would also be part of it.
In defense of Obama and his camp on foreign policy, do you really think things would be so much different in Syria if we had given arms to the rebels earlier on, which is, I think, what people called for?
Well, it's one of the things we could have done. We also should have done more to protect civilians directly. We also should have attacked the government, grounded its air force when it used chemical weapons. And that would have been good not just for Syria, but it would have sent the message worldwide that the United States means what it says in general. And second of all, the United States is prepared to act against the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. So the costs of what this past president didn't do in Syria actually transcend that geography.
On the chemical weapons, I wonder if Obama gets a bad rap on that red line statement about chemical weapons in Syria that he always gets knocked for. He said at the time, a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus. He didn't say we'd invade or ground their air force. And Obama maintains to this day, I'm sure you heard it in one of those last news conferences, that what he did was better than an invasion. There was a threat, and that caused Syria to give up the chemical weapons. WMDs addressed. Do you not consider that a policy success?
The short answer is no. The idea of an invasion is a red herring. We had all sorts of limited military options that we could and should have carried out that I believe still would have led to the decision by the government to get rid of all of its chemical weapons. But it also had the potential not just to back up the word of the United States, but to change the momentum of the Syrian civil war. So again, the president, I know what he says. He said it in various interviews. I simply think it doesn't wash.
And you think that we wouldn't have wound up having to occupy Syria like we occupied Iraq with all those consequences if we decided we were in charge of what his military could do?
Again, the idea of occupying it was never a serious option and should not have been. Look, if the United States was that opposed unalterably to any involvement in Syria, then the president, Mr. Obama, never should have said Assad must go. Because any time you articulate ambitious goals, you would better be prepared to back them up. But once he articulated that Assad must go and talked about backing the opposition, then it seems to me he had a full range of options. And again, he looked at it time and time again. And it underscores the large point that in foreign policy, what you don't do can be every bit as consequential as what you do do. And one of the reasons that this is a world of disarray, quite honestly, is because in the Middle East, in Ukraine, in parts of Asia, the previous administration, and in many cases, believed to basically decided not to act.
Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called The World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. We can take your phone calls, folks, and even though I started with it, I don't want to spend too much time debating the Obama administration, your calls primarily to Richard Haass about what faces President Trump and what he's been doing so far. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And to the present moment, we played that clip of Trump on ABC yesterday on taking the oil when we were in Iraq to build schools in Brooklyn in L.A., I think is how he finished that thought a little later. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I guess that would put me down as a fool. It's not simply the idea that
he said it's not critics, it's fools who oppose
right,
that.
So yes. I've been called worse. It's not just that it would violate international law. It would raise fundamental questions about U.S. motives, which, by the way, were not for commercial economic gain related to oil. We also would have faced a massive act of a nationalist armed resistance if we had done that. Essentially, we would have brought the entire country against us because we would have looked like an imperial power rather than a principled power. So the whole idea of taking oil and the idea that it would have prevented the rise of ISIS, if anything, it would have accelerated and intensified the rise of ISIS and other radical Sunni armed groups.
Is that just Trump being weirdly Trumpian about something he can't actually do, or does a statement like that have consequences for American troops or anyone else, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's a sign of what his view is about the world, particularly when the other clip you played, which he basically said we spent $6 trillion in the Middle East that should have been spent at home. And again, I was a critic of the Iraq war. I opposed it when I was inside government, and I think lots of the money we spent was ill-advised. But somehow to suggest that if we had only spent less overseas, everything would be just fine here at home is wrong. Our problems here at home are for the most part not because of a lack of spending. And if anything, you know, there's nothing about what we did in the Middle East that precluded us from reforming entitlements or doing a better job to prevent the 2008 financial crisis. So to somehow blame or scapegoat foreign policy with what ails us here at home is setting up an entire set of choices that quite honestly are false.
Which I guess means you wouldn't be a fan in general of the framing of U.S. foreign policy as America first. But some on the left as well as the right, as you know, are happy after the Iraq War overreach at the prospect of not throwing our superpower weight around as much as during the Cold War. Trump says Iraq and the world would be better off today had we left Saddam Hussein in power, bad as he was. What about America first? If we assume he doesn't mean what Charles Lindbergh meant in 1939, what does that actually mean to you?
Well, I worry that the articulation or implementation of a doctrine of America first would actually add to the disarray or disorder in the world. It sends a message that the United States is going to calculate very narrowly what it plans to do in the world from a very, again, narrow American self-interest. That's at odds with the fact that we have been someone who supported allies, who supported order in the world, not as an act of philanthropy, but also as an act of self-interest. And I worry, Brian, that when other countries hear this, one of two things are going to happen. Either they will say, we can't count on the United States, so therefore we're going to have to defer to the strongest local country, say China in Asia or Russia in Europe, or they're going to say, we can't count on the United States, and now we have to take matters into our own hands. And I don't want to see a world come about where other countries start saying they've got to do everything themselves, because that will be a world, among other things, where nuclear weapons are likely to proliferate.
I have a hard time figuring out, to be honest, how interventionist or non-interventionist Trump plans to be when he says America first. He criticizes the Bush administration for the Iraq War, obviously, but he criticizes the Obama administration for not enough military action in Syria. I guess you do both of those things, too. And he says he'll quickly wipe out ISIS. So it's a jumble to me. Do you get what he actually does intend to do?
No, I think a jumble or whatever other word you want to use is probably fair. It's not intellectually necessarily consistent. In some areas, there are real contradictions. I don't think at the moment there's a Trump doctrine, though what we are seeing is a pattern of disruption, a pattern of questioning existing arrangements, be they trade-related or alliance or arrangements or diplomatic arrangements, but almost a little bit like healthcare. I get a sense of what Mr. Trump wants to repeal. I don't get a clear sense of what he wants to replace it with.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Philomena in Westchester. Philomena, you're on WNYC with Richard Haass. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you. I wanted to ask, given the position you just stated about your opposition to taking the oil, we have approximately 5,000 troops in Iraq, and it seems to me that obviously they're already in tremendous danger just trying to fight ISIS, assisting and training the Iraqi soldiers. But with Trump's comments, both during the campaign and post-election about taking the oil, and those now appearing on the news in Iraq, seems to me that our soldiers are in greater danger by the people in Iraq believing we are there to take their oil. And I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
And that was the context of David Muir's question, I believe, on ABC. He said, does this put American troops in danger, Richard?
Well, the short answer is I hope not. The equally short answer is I don't know. The mission of U.S. troops in Iraq, these 5,000 or 5,500 troops, is fairly narrow. It's a limited counterterrorism mission. It's mainly a mission to help Iraqi government forces do a better job. And again, I think things are going fairly well in Iraq. The real question is whether the Iraqis themselves can run a society in which there's national identity rather than one that's sectarian. I think the bigger question and problem is going to come for the much smaller number of American troops in Syria, where we're going to be attacking ISIS. And unlike in Iraq, it's not clear what comes afterwards. It's not clear who will take any territory that is captured. And that, to me, is the big issue, because these peace talks going on in Syria are unlikely to succeed. This is not going to be a normal country for any time soon, and this is not going to be a normal region anytime soon.
Why do you say you think things are going fairly well now in Iraq? That probably surprised a lot of listeners.
Well, I think the attack against Mosul, which is the Iraqi base for ISIS, is essentially going slowly, but it's going in the right direction. I think it's a question of when and not if ISIS loses its territorial position in Iraq and they regroup in Syria. And then again, I think the challenge for the Iraqis is to show they can have a national society rather than a Shia-dominated society where Sunnis and Kurds feel like outsiders. So I think the battle will go well. What I don't know is how well the aftermath will go.
Anthony in Manasquan, you're on WNYC with Richard Haass. Hello, Anthony.
Hi, Brian. Pleasure to talk to you. My question is, do you think this is like a greater strategy to create civil unrest? Like for example, like the divisive language, the alternative facts, creating distrust between the public and the media, and just like generally like stirring things up.
So this isn't a foreign policy question. You're asking about civil unrest in this country and whether that's actually Trump's plan?
Well, yes, because he's kind of going that way anyway with, like, the defunding, like, women's, like, reproductive rights and stuff like that, and that's, like, a global effect. And I'm just wondering if you think it's, like, kind of like a way to create civil unrest.
Anthony, thank you. Richard, do you have any thought about that?
Well, again, I think this is part and parcel of Mr. Trump being a disruptor. For example, his support for Brexit. And, you know, again, this threatens in some ways the fabric of the entire post-World War II economic and political and security order in Europe. And again, however great its flaws, it looks far preferable to me than any realistic alternative. So I worry that in many of these areas, Mr. Trump is challenging the status quo. But I am unpersuaded that there is something preferable that he will be able to put in its place. I mean, another example is with Mexico. Here he is, you know, talking about building a wall, perhaps undoing NAFTA. This is to me ironic because at the moment there's no net flow of Mexicans into the United States. There's a net outflow. And what worries me is this can set in motion changes within the Mexican economy. It could bring to power Mexico a real populist in their next presidential election, which in turn could disrupt the country enough. So once again, we will have immigration pressures on our borders. So a lot of this seems disruption, but not thinking through what are likely to be the first, second, third order effects of what it is we're setting in motion.
If those stats are right, why is there a net outflow of Mexicans from this country rather than inflow? The assumption of most Americans would be that there's still more economic opportunity here, which should create net immigration.
There actually isn't. Mexico in recent years has been growing at a higher rate than the United States, which is not surprising because it begins at a lower baseline. Mexican families have been smaller. So rather than some of the sons staying home and some coming to the United States, now the pressure is on most or all of the sons to stay home. Jobs are being eliminated in the United States, not because of trade agreements, but because of new technologies. So for all these reasons, along with border security improvements, more people have been staying home in Mexico than coming here.
Dennis in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Dennis.
Good morning, everybody. What the president gets most when he's inaugurated is that he has now the ability to negotiate with the power of the United States behind him. That is something that Obama stripped away from day one. He never knew how to leverage the power of the United States without firing a bullet. And you saw that in Syria, you saw that in Ukraine. No one took him seriously. Trump is the opposite. He knows how to leverage the power of any company he's ever led and of the United States now to his great advantage. And I think all this talk, is like Richard was saying, is just a matter of being a disruptor and a negotiator. And everyone should take it easy.
Dennis, thank you. And that's the Trump supporters' view of Trump's bluster. You know, it's take him seriously, not literally, on foreign policy. Maybe the bluster strengthens the U.S. because we look unpredictable and more to be feared, therefore, which maybe is Trump's point.
It may be his point, but I'm not sure it translates well, Brian, into foreign policy. A lot of foreign policy is being consistent. It's being reliable. It's reassuring your friends who depend on us for their fundamental security or economic needs. And also it means that our adversaries may not take us as 100% sure to resist certain things. So it probably increases the odds that our adversaries will test us. And in some cases, the disruption, say, with China, by putting on the table some of the fundamentals of U.S.-China relations, I think essentially shut down any possibility of the United States and China, say, cooperating on what could be the biggest challenge facing this president, which will be a North Korea that has nuclear weapons, that can go on missiles, that can reach the continental United States. So, again, you know, Mr. Trump has obviously had a storied career in the real estate business. I am unpersuaded that what worked in that environment translates at all well into being commander-in-chief.
Richard Haass with us, president of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of a new book, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. Let me follow up on a couple of things you just said. Number one on China, I know in the book you say, you know, even though we focus on the Middle East and the media all the time and the politicians do too, that our relationship with China is the most important thing going forward. Why do you think so?
Absolutely. I actually think the U.S.-China relationship will be the defining relationship of this new century. How it goes, much of the history of this century will go. China's 1.3 billion people. It's the world's second largest economy, plus it's an economy that is integrated into the regional and world economy. China has a lot of military weight, political weight, economic weight. And so it has tremendous impact on regional issues as well as global issues. So I would simply say it's in our interest to try to get it right, whether it's dealing with global challenges like disease or climate change or trade, or dealing with regional challenges like North Korea. I think we have every incentive to continue to finesse the areas where we disagree and to try to expand the areas where we potentially agree.
So I know you're a supporter of free trade in general, and I guess the TPP, and I guess the irony of pulling out of TPP, according to supporters of the pact, is that the effect will be to make China stronger relative to the United States. Is that your position?
Exactly. It enhances China's position. China's putting forward an alternative regional economic arrangement, which doesn't have anything like as high a set of standards as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This one will not include us. So I really don't understand. I mean, don't get me wrong. I disagree with a lot of this and what this new administration is saying about China. I think it's unwisely or ill-advisedly confrontational. But as you say, it's then doubly ironic that in the trade area, what we are doing, the principal beneficiary of it will be China, which again is, it makes no sense on its own terms. Plus, it's inconsistent with the larger thrust of this administration's approach to the region.
Although Trump says we can negotiate individual trade deals with the countries in the TPP and accomplish the same pushback against China without as many disadvantages for American workers. Well, why not true?
It's just not true. First of all, it's wildly inefficient and time-consuming to try to negotiate individual deals. And several things can only be done on a regional or global basis when it comes to things like eliminating subsidies. Well, you either eliminate a subsidy totally or you don't. You can't just say we're going to eliminate a subsidy in the bilateral context but not in the regional or global context. Plus, again, we have in the TPP, we had, 40 to 45% of the world's economic power in that one agreement. That would have been an unbelievable opportunity to raise the trade with those countries to a better level and to set a standard that, by the way, China would have had to meet if it wanted to join TPP. So rather now than having a race to the top, we're likely to have a race to the bottom. And I don't see how that's good for Americans, be it, you know, those people whose jobs depend on exports. Those jobs will now not grow the way they would have, or for American consumers. So again, this doesn't make economic or strategic sense to me.
And I think you said a few minutes ago that North Korea may be the threat we should be most concerned about. A lot of people probably see the North Korean leadership as evil, but kind of shrug relative to ISIS, which has agents all over the place, either officially or inspired by ISIS. And people think, oh, Kim Jong-un is a fascist wacko, but he's not really going to bomb the United States with nuclear weapons. Do you take it more seriously than that?
I do, because when Kim Jong-un gets, you know, reaches the point, and if all things are being equal, he'll reach it within a couple of years, if not sooner, of being able to put these warheads on missiles that can reach the United States. Why do we want to have a situation where we have to depend, and our well-being depends upon his good judgment and his restraint? That's not a situation that fills me with great comfort any more than the idea of depending upon ISIS's restraint fills me with great comfort. So I think we need to do something about both. I would say the same thing about Russia. I don't want to depend upon Mr. Putin's self-limitations. But no, I take North Korea seriously. This is the most militarized, closed society on the planet. And I simply don't feel confident making predictions that they would behave in a responsible fashion.
Dave in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. You're on WNYC with Richard Haass. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Your guest complained about President Obama not doing more in Syria, after Assad used chemical weapons. But our Constitution requires our president to get approval from Congress to declare war on another country. President Obama did request authorization from Congress, and the Republicans in Congress rejected that request. So my question is, what in your book do you mention about the fact that President Obama did try to do more in Syria but was rejected by the Republicans in Congress?
Look, the history of the United States since World War II is 98 or 99% of the uses of military force by the United States were done by presidents without formal declarations of war by the Congress. You can argue whether that is good or bad, but it's simply a fact and a fact of life. So if President Obama had wanted to use military force in the aftermath of the Syrians using chemical weapons, he had every prerogative to do so, and in my view, he should have. I don't agree with those Republicans who wanted to stop him, but again, President Obama had no need, given the practice of the presidency, to go to Congress for a formal authorization. We were not going to war, quote unquote, with Syria. It would have been a limited military action. And again, there is enormous precedent for presidents undertaking limited military actions without formal authorization from Congress.
I know you got to go in a couple of minutes. A few things real quick, if we can. Russia. Did Russia change the outcome of our election, in your opinion?
I've seen no evidence that it did. What's clear is that Russia interfered. I haven't seen any study suggest that it interfered with a material result. But look, this was not a one-off, Brian. They conquered part of Ukraine. They're interfering with the rest of it. They committed war crimes in Syria. So this is part of a larger challenge of Russian behavior, even if they didn't materially affect the outcome of our political process.
With your connections within the intelligence community, do you think there's evidence of Trump colluding with Russia to harm the Clinton campaign in any way?
I've not seen any evidence that supports that. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I've just not seen any evidence that supports that.
And where Putin and Trump might be right, in the opinion of some on the left as well as the right, is that NATO overreach after the collapse of the Soviet Union helped to create Putin. Why do we place sanctions on Russia over Ukraine any more than Russia should place sanctions over us toward, you know, what we do toward Cuba or Mexico on our borders?
Well, I think historians will debate the wisdom of NATO enlargement after the end of the Cold War, and both the general proposition as well as some of the specific instances of it. And there will be those who say that we violated Winston Churchill's maxim, that in victory, magnanimity, and we didn't show great magnanimity towards Russia. But that said, Ukraine was not part of that process. It was outside of NATO, and I think what Mr. Putin did in Ukraine wasn't a reaction to NATO. I think it was a reaction to the president of Ukraine getting chased out of the presidential palace by a mob, and Mr. Putin didn't want that precedent to stand because he doesn't want a mob in Moscow chasing him out of the Kremlin.
So in our last minute, we started the segment with a clip of Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, who's going to be the first head of state to meet with Trump tomorrow. She's under all kinds of pressure at home to push back on Trump, on climate change, on torture. What do you think that meeting's really going to be about?
Well, what I think both are trying to do is come up with an alternative. President Trump wants to show that outside of normal trade policies, that the United States and Britain can have something special, that and that Theresa May wants to say, despite Brexit, the special relationship with the United States can prosper, Britain can prosper with a bilateral agreement. I'm not sure either one of them is right, but both of them have a political incentive to try to give the appearance that there's a viable bilateral alternative here to either traditional trade arrangements or, in the case of Britain, to membership in the EU.
So that sounds like a lot of nice-nice and not much of what those members of parliament were asking for, which is for her to push them to stay in the climate change agreement and things like that.
I would think you're not too far off the mark. She does not want this to be a confrontational meeting. She wants this to be a success.
Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll continue in a minute.